Welcome to the Ohio Star Podcast. I am your host, Neil W. McCabe, the national political editor of the Star News Network, a constellation of 11 state-focused news sites, including the Ohio Star. This week, we kick it off with my conversation with Star reporter Peter DeBrasca about his coverage of President Joseph R. Biden nominating Ohio's own Stephen Dettelbach to be his director of alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. Peter also talked about his reporting on South Carolina Republican Congresswoman Nancy Mace. Mace is a former 2016 campaign worker for Donald J. Trump, who could only be described as Trump impeachment curious. She did not join the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach President Trump in January of 2021, but she came wicked, wicked close. Next up is my conversation with attorney Kurt Hartman, who represents Mary Capella, who filed two campaign finance complaints against GOP gubernatorial candidate Joe Blystone and his campaign with the Ohio Elections Commission. Hartman explains why Capella is now suing in the Supreme Court of Ohio the Elections Commission because they literally blew off the Ohio law that requires the commission to expedite action on complaints filed within 60 days of an election or primary. Finally, you'll hear my conversation with Russell Stewart, the owner of Beverly Hills Guns. Stewart got a letter from his property manager telling him to pack up and leave within 60 days. But let's start off with my conversation with Star reporter Peter DeBrasca. Peter, how are you doing, sir?
Neil, I'm doing well. It's great to be here.
Welcome back to the Ohio Star podcast. There's one story close to my heart, because for about 3 or 4 years, I was the editor of the Guns and Patriots newsletter at Human Events. The gun thing is always, it's almost like a side hustle to other things that I've been working on. You have a story about a son of Ohio who just got the nod from President Joe Biden. What is his name, and what does the president want him to do?
That's right. So Steve Dettelbach, who ran for the Attorney General of Ohio unsuccessfully in 2018 against current Attorney General Dave Yost, was appointed, or nominated, I guess, to be the head of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, ATF, which, you know, is a sort of a, I guess, a failure upwards for somebody who lost when he tried to become Ohio's top attorney general, or top attorney.
Well, yeah, that was in 2018, which was a wave year, right? He didn't run in 2020. That was 2018.
That's right.
Yeah, and so that was a Democratic wave year, which was supposed to sweep people up. And of course, Sherrod Brown beat Jim Renacci in that Senate fight. What do we know about this character?
Well, he was also the former district attorney for the Northern District of Ohio. He is a bona fide Trump hater. I looked at much of his old tweets today. Was not a fan of President Trump, as you might imagine. He received a sparkling sort of string of admiration from President Biden today in the Rose Garden, when President Biden essentially went up there actually and discussed his entire gun control agenda once again, including a national registry for firearms, by the way, and essentially said that Steve Dettelbach is the guy who's going to help us get it done. It wasn't really even a thinly veiled attempt to let Americans know that their Second Amendment rights are going to be eroded. It was essentially just a statement that that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, we've entered the smash and grab phase of the Biden presidency. He sees the red wave that's coming, and so he's got to get as much done as he possibly can. Maybe try to reboot the news cycle, because we've got even more bad news coming, you know, on inflation and gas prices and everything else.
Funny, I don't think anybody expects that Democrats are not going to take a beating this November. They've certainly owned it. And I think you're right. I think they're kind of in panic mode, in struggle mode. They're trying to blame literally every problem on Vladimir Putin.
I think what's going to happen with Dettelbach, he is going to go into that buzzsaw that is the U.S. Senate right now, that split 50-50 with Kamala Harris being able to cast a tie vote as vice president. But increasingly, there are Democratic senators who are saying, hey, I don't need to take a bad gun vote right now because there's an election coming up.
That's right.
And, you know, I think there's a feeling, and it's driven by White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain. You just keep pushing to the base, right? They think the reason why Trump was successful is because he played to his base. They don't seem to understand that Trump was successful because he was listening to his base.
I think Trump's base was far larger than Biden's base. I mean, this is still a center-right country, and this is something that we're kind of highlighting at the start. It's like the left, at this point, is really just a vocal minority. When you think about what the left is, right, the entire progressive agenda is, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 or 15% of the population maximum. And so it's like, you know, what audience is Biden playing to? He's not playing to the center left. He's got to play to the progressives. And it's, I mean, he's just trying to walk this tightrope. It's not working out. I mean, Trump had a vast swath of the American people to talk to. Joe Biden can barely even talk. You know, when he does talk, it barely makes any sense. Confirmation is going to probably go similarly to the way the attempt to ram David Chipman through. David Chipman maybe was a little bit more of a controversial figure than Steve Dettelbach. I mean, David Chipman, of course, was the first ATF nominee from the Biden administration, and eventually that nomination was withdrawn because he worked for Giffords, which is Gabrielle Giffords' nonprofit anti-gun group. It's sort of an extreme far-left anti-gun group, and you know, there was opposition, like you say, from the senators who were trying to toe the line, like Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, these Democrat senators in typically red states. We might have the same outcome here, despite the fact that this Dettelbach character seems to be, I guess you would call him, more moderate than the first one, than David Chipman was.
Well, he's more professional, he's more serious. You know, he's going to try to, you know, speak to the senators as someone on their level. He was, as you said, he was the U.S. attorney under Obama. He did run for attorney general, right? So he got the nomination. I mean, he has those kinds of chops that Chipman didn't have. And we'll see how it goes. I just, you know, I can't see, unless, of course, you know, Collins, Romney, and Murkowski decide, you know, that they're going to continue to save the Biden presidency. Certainly John Thune, who's the Senate Republican whip, he's the guy who's supposed to get people in line to oppose the president's nominations. You know, he's actually been quoted saying, basically, I'm not going to vote for this bill because I'm up for re-election this year, but I don't care if anybody else votes for it because, you know, we could all use a little pork now and then. So, you know, so there, that's John Thune. John Cornyn is a guy who for the last, I don't know, maybe 10 years, every 2 years, he files a national concealed carry reciprocity bill that is then immediately read into the record and sent to the Judiciary Committee, where it sits and does not move. He's filed like 4 or 5 of these bills. He gets like 30 or 40 co-sponsors. And so they all put out press releases saying that they support national concealed carry reciprocity. It never moves, yet it was John Cornyn who stripped national concealed carry reciprocity out of the background check bill that passed in 2018 as the Republicans were losing that midterm. But going into that losing midterm, Cornyn actually put the Republicans on record restricting gun rights, which is quite a trick. And he's already been on the record saying that, yes, I am talking to the Biden administration and Democrats about how to further restrict gun rights as a, to be in the middle ground. And so, you know, Cornyn, he's like one of the guys who's up to replace McConnell. And so I just never trust Republicans on gun rights. We'll see what happens with Dettelbach. There was another story that interested me, and I'm really obsessed with these people, House Republicans who voted to impeach Trump. And then there's another category, and these are like the impeachment curious Republicans. Nancy Mace is always kind of like, she's someone who worked in the Trump campaign. Trump put her in Congress. There is no doubt that Trump's endorsement got her into Congress. And then, you know, and then she flipped, and then she became like, she sort of woke up from her slumber. And she realized what a menace Trump was, but she just stopped short of voting to impeach him in the second impeachment, the January 2021 impeachment. But she says all the negative things that get her interviews on CNN and MSNBC and whatnot. What is your story on Nancy Mace, Peter?
Well, Nancy Mace, now that it's politically convenient, is all of a sudden making TV appearances calling for an investigation into the Hunter Biden laptop, now infamous Hunter Biden laptop, which she did not do when the story broke in October 2020, a crucial presidential election. We all know how that turned out. And so you're absolutely right. It's just one of these situations where Nancy Mace gets the top endorsement and she wins her seat in Congress and does absolutely nothing to fight for the Trump agenda at all. And turns on Trump literally in a matter of weeks, right, from being sworn in. It was her first week, actually, as a U.S. congresswoman. And she was, as you say, impeachment curious. She said something to the effect of, you know, Trump needs to be punished and the people who stormed the Capitol need to be punished. And even my fellow members of Congress who were involved need to be punished. But, you know, we're rushing this impeachment process. And I don't know if that's a precedent. Her opponent, Katie Arrington, is now endorsed by Trump, and I think people are still going to follow the Trump endorsements. But all of a sudden, Nancy Mace is on national TV calling for this investigation, or we're gonna subpoena Hunter Biden. We're gonna put him up in front of the Oversight Committee, and we're gonna get to the bottom of this.
She was supposed to be the voice of the new Republican Party post Trump. This is an interesting seat because it belonged to Mark Sanford, who is one of the early Never Trump guys. Of course, he went down. Of course, and Arrington, who is now the Trump-endorsed candidate against Mace, but she was in a car accident, right, in 2018?
That's right.
So I think I got this narrative correct. She beat Sanford in the primary, but then was in a car accident and lost to the Democrat. And then Mace won the seat back in 2020,
right,
because Trump had a coattails that carried a number of House Republicans. And I think the people who rigged the 2020 election knew better than to screw around with the House races. And so, you know, in fact, I actually told somebody at the NRCC about a month before the election, I said, you guys are going to retake the House. And they would have retaken the House if they saw the opportunities. But now Mace lost that endorsement. And right after Trump endorsed Arrington, I mean, she was basically saying, hey, I'm the Trump candidate. Well, like, what did she think was going to happen? Did she think people would just forget what she's been up to?
It's one of those, like, I'm grassroots just like you, right? Here's my cell phone video. It doesn't seem like anything has changed. So, I mean,
well, Mace had promise, okay? She had promise.
Yeah.
She had a compelling personal story. And I think, you know, the unfortunate thing that happened is that she hired people who worked for Liz Cheney to work for her. And she actually did a fundraiser with Liz Cheney on Capitol Hill. You know, she just bought into this Liz Cheney vision, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, this is like the common theme. Everybody wants to be the Trump-endorsed candidate. And everybody says, I'm pro-Trump. And when this is like, you know, I think we could see this coming over the last few years. It's like the Populist Inc. or the America First Incorporated, right? Where everybody kind of tries to ride the Trump coattails. And then you have to decipher who the real ones are and who the real ones are not. And unfortunately, a lot of the ones who are not are slipping through the cracks. I mean, there are some sort of tells, right? It's, you know, have you hired a massive Washington-based consulting firm? And if so, you're probably not, the populist, true pro-Trump America First candidate, right? You're looking for a grassroots. You know, and the grassroots people have a hard time with Trump, and it's why I think we end up disappointed in so many different occasions.
Well, you know, somebody asked me recently, why isn't Peter on Twitter? And you're still not on social media, Peter?
No social media for me. I am off of the social media. Feels great. I would encourage everybody to give it a try. Although the most shares of Twitter now, I think there's going to be some major changes there. But I'm fine to sit back and sort of spectate.
All right, Peter. Well, thank you very much for being on the Ohio Star podcast, and we'll see you next week.
All right. Thanks, Neil.
Republican Joe Blystone's campaign for governor has been marred by his flawed handling of cash contributions and questionable expenditures, which we have covered at the Ohio Star in some depth. Here's my conversation with attorney Kurt Hartman, whose client has filed two complaints against Blystone based on his 2021 annual campaign filing with the state, and whose client filed Monday a lawsuit in the Ohio Supreme Court asking the court to direct the Ohio Elections Commission to do their job. Here's that conversation.
Kurt, thank you very much for being on with me. You filed a lawsuit Monday with the Supreme Court in Ohio regarding a complaint against Joe Blystone's campaign. Who did you file that on behalf of, and what is the narrative that you're telling the court?
No problem. It was filed on behalf of Mary Capella, who's a voter in Butler County. And it's a challenge to the inaction and the avoidance of responsibility by the Ohio Elections Commission to enforce the campaign finance laws of the state of Ohio. The whole essence of the campaign finance laws is open and timely disclosure of the information relative to campaigns so voters can be informed about candidates. And Ms. Capella became aware through the campaign filings of the Blystone campaign in January of certain irregularities, both in terms of contributions and expenditures. And so on behalf of Ms. Capella, we filed two complaints with the Ohio Elections Commission dealing with those issues, the contributions and the expenditures, looking at potential what appears to be potential conversion of campaign funds for personal use, irregularities in fundraising, not reporting contributions, very similar to a complaint that was filed a few months ago against the Blystone campaign on a different finance report. And then the complaint that Ms. Capella filed with the Ohio Elections Commission under state law is entitled to an expedited hearing, essentially a preliminary hearing within 2 days and then a full hearing within 10 days of that. And shockingly and disappointingly, the Ohio Elections Commission or the executive director essentially informed us on the Friday before we filed the lawsuit with the Supreme Court. On that Friday, he informed us that he was not going to expedite it, and good luck. And so we believe under state law, he has a clear legal duty to expedite the lawsuit, expedite the complaint with the Elections Commission. And so last Monday, we filed what's called a mandamus action with the Ohio Supreme Court to try to get a court order to force the commission to give us that expedited hearing in order, in essence, follow the law.
Okay, I was just going to say that's Latin for do your job, right?
Correct. They have a legal duty to do it. They're not doing it. Order them to do it.
And the commission, the commission sort of, when you mentioned to them, hey, I might actually file one of these do your job motions, and Phil Richter, he's the executive director of the commission, and some of the members kind of laughed it off.
Yeah. It came up briefly at the end of their meeting. They had a meeting on April 7th, and the complaint was filed that morning, and Phil Richter was aware of it. I had just come in the office, and he kind of apprised them. I had been talking to him about needing to expedite it, and I said, Phil, if you don't do it, I'm going to have to file a mandamus action against the commission. And at this meeting on April 7th, they kind of said, well, kind of laughed about it because I'm not sure it's really going to get resolved by the Ohio Supreme Court before the primary. And so I don't know what good it's going to do, kind of laughing about it. Hey, so good luck to them. We're trying to get the Ohio Supreme Court to expedite the case, still waiting to see on that.
Yeah, and I appreciate you don't have a lot of time for me, but I do want to ask you, when you say conversion of campaign funds, which you mentioned in the complaint, how would you describe that for our listeners?
Well, under campaign finance law, the expenditures by any campaign committee have to be for legitimate, necessary, and ordinary campaign expenses. You can't go buy a boat and say, hey, I'm going to host stuff on a boat, and then turn around and use a boat for your personal.
Yourself.
Right. So, it's got to be ordinary, necessary type of campaign expenditures. And there are some indications, not as significant, you know, a couple hundred dollars up to $1,000 of expenditures at a few apparel stores, you know, basically clothing. And I actually conferred with Phil Richter at the commission, and it was, hey, those type of expenditures, generally speaking, are not allowable. You can't go buy yourself, you can't run for office, raise money, and then go buy yourself a suit, because that suit isn't really a necessary and no ordinary campaign expenditure. It's something you use more for your personal use, even after the campaign.
Even if you have a Mr. Green Jeans persona that you're showing to the voters.
That's part of the issue. We got to get the facts clarified, but I think there's at least a good faith and probable cause to raise the questions and say we need to get the facts out, or the voters need to get the facts out. You know, it's one thing if you want to buy, like, let's say, an Uncle Sam outfit just to march in a parade in, you know, and you would never be caught dead in it in any other time. Something like that may be fine, because that would be solely. Well, it'd be solely for the campaign. Here, when you can use stuff after the campaign for your own personal benefit and enjoyment, that's generally speaking not allowed under campaign finance law.
Now, in the last, you're citing the year-long report for all of 2021. In his previous 6-month report, it was something like $87,000 in cash contributions. The Secretary of State, Frank LaRose, put out basically a report saying that unless he can explain this, he has to return this money. But, of course, he doesn't know where it came from. He doesn't know who gave it to him.
Right.
He doesn't record who gave it to him, and he doesn't record how much they gave, because he basically was passing around a bucket. You're saying he did the same thing. He continued to do this practice even as the complaints are coming through.
Yeah. Craig, it appears he did. I don't know about passing the bucket, but the way his finance report – he filed – let me back up. He filed a campaign finance report called the semiannual report in July of 2021. That is what the old complaint that some of his former campaign staffers filed. Then at the end of January, he filed an annual report that covered from July to December of last year. Got my dog going there. So, yeah, we basically – the most recent complaint dealt with the annual report that was just filed in January. And so that, you know, it looks like the contribution stuff was the same, you know, broad reports of – locations or events without any attribution. It's about $95,000 in this most recent report that really is not attributed to any specific individuals.
And the key thing there is not so much that they're against cash contributions, but there is a threshold, a cumulative threshold, that once you get to the $100 mark, everything has to be recorded, who you are, how much you gave. And so I have to keep track of you, because you may have given me, you know, if you give me $20 five times, that last $20 hits the mark. So now the whole 100 has to be recorded, and he has no way of doing that. And so it's really ignoring the spirit and the letter of the law.
It is, yeah. Ohio law, you cannot contribute cumulatively more than $100 in cash to a campaign. And you're right. If people are making multiple cash contributions, there's the prospect of that going above and beyond that. The other thing in terms of reporting is they do not have to report individual contributions of $25 or less. They have to keep track of it, but they don't have to do a separate line entry. But the problem you have here is getting a lot of, you know, $1,400, $2,000 reports of this location or this event. And if you look at this, like I said, about $95,000, if everybody gave the $25, you're over 3,000 individuals. There's just some, and it's like 28% of the total contributions they raised. I mean, I've been in campaigns for 20-plus years, never seen anything like that. You know, donations of that magnitude.
If you're an Ohio statewide candidate and you have 3,000 small dollar donors, that's a pretty strong campaign. And there's no evidence that Blystone has that kind of swath.
Correct. Yeah. And like I said, and this was kind of the same as the earlier filed complaint, and the commission at least initially said, yes, there's sufficient grounds here to move forward. We're looking to do the same thing, but because of the timing of this complaint that we filed, within 60 days, they have the obligation for that expedited hearing, which they are not giving us. Because in a certain sense, you want people need to have as much information, the full information, before the election, not after the election, not at 6 months, a year after the election. It does no good. And it undermines the purposes of the campaign finance laws.
Well, very good. Kurt Hartman, thank you very much for being on the Ohio Star podcast. Take care, man.
Very good. Thank you.
Russell Stewart is the owner of Beverly Hills Guns, which is not a traditional gun store. It is more like a confidential concierge service for people who are very private about their firearms. Stewart was getting a lot of publicity as crime in his city escalated. So for reasons you can guess, he was the one who had to go. Here's that conversation.
So I just want to start off with some basic stuff. Where did you grow up, and so what was your initial interest or curiosity about firearms and getting involved in guns?
Well, I was born in Vancouver, Canada, and I moved to the United States in my 20s pursued a career in entertainment. I was a talent manager for a very long time, and I was doing, I was getting involved in security work while I was, because a lot of my clients needed security, so I started doing a bunch of training. I joined the California State Guard in the military here in California, continued training in protective services, and then in 2017 I launched my own security firm called Force Protection Agency. So for a good decade or so, I've been either carrying a firearm or involved in firearms issues. And then it was during the pandemic. Well, actually, I'll step back. I wanted to get into the firearms, like the federal firearms dealership side of things, for probably 20 years, actually. I grew up with guns. I grew up shooting guns, and they were just a part of my life. But it wasn't until maybe 10 years ago or so is where I really wanted to have a shop, and I really wanted to have a shop in Beverly Hills. I've been in Beverly Hills now for 15 years. And, I had attempted to get a license several years ago, and it just didn't pan out for certain reasons. And then finally the pandemic hit, and my wife, she was the one that championed it and said, I think this is the time to go after it. And I did, and it came to fruition, and Beverly Hills Guns was born.
Now, what did you do with the when you were in the California Guard? What was your MOS, and did you deploy it all?
Well, this is the State Guard, so it's the it's not the National Guard. It's the state.
So it's like New York, other places will have like a militia. Is that what it was?
Well, it's still under the California Military Department. It's all Title 32, it's all legit. It's not like those hokey, like state militias. But yes, I was in the State Guard. My current rank is captain, and I'm an emergency management specialist.
Okay, and so what would happen is if there was some kind of fire or earthquake or something, you guys would get the call to help out with other public safety professionals.
Exactly.
With the state.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Fantastic. Are you allowed to talk about who your clients are, or can you give me some idea of some of the people who came into your shop, especially in the beginning, who said, thank goodness you're here?
Unfortunately, I can never name names because that's a big part of our business model is the anonymity. I mean, that's why people liked our shop, especially during the pandemic when, you know, there was 15-hour-a-day lineups at every single gun store. So to have prominent people to be able to come into somewhere where they can exercise their rights, but just not be as public about it, that was a huge selling feature for them. I mean, call it hypocritical, or not. I've done tons of interviews where people just kind of want me to give dirt on forward-facing liberals who then crap on guns in the public and then need guns when the world goes to hell. But in the end, my job is not to judge people. My job is to give people the services to exercise their Second Amendment rights, and that's what I was incredibly proud of. Now, the best I can say is we've had prominent people in that you know exactly who they are because you've seen their films or you've seen them on television, and also leaders in industry, from real estate moguls to prominent surgeons to people, from all walks of life. But definitely because of my location, it's more of the upper echelon type of person.
And do you do business also with film armors, and do you do any studio work?
I do have a California entertainment firearms permit, so I do have the legal ability to do that kind of work, but I've just never pulled the trigger, no pun intended.
Okay.
But I'd like to get into more of it.
Okay. And then the other thing I wanted to ask you before we get back to the store is obviously with the movie Rust, people are concerned about, how firearms are handled on movies and, frankly, how they could possibly be live bullets. What is your take on Rust, and what are your customers telling you about Rust and Alec Baldwin and that shooting?
Well, obviously when it happened, it was the talk of everyone that came to the shop for quite a long time, and it continues to this day. I mean, look, the bottom line is, in my opinion, and obviously I'm not a lawyer, but in my opinion, the bullet that comes out of a gun comes down to the last person who's holding it.
When you start getting the whispers or the rumbles that this lease was going to be called on you, and just to be clear, you said 2017, when in 2017 did you open?
No. I started my security firm in 2017, which owns the gun shop. The gun shop itself opened in early 2020.
Okay. And the truth is, in life, right, before something happens, you feel the tremors, you feel like you hear the whispers. Like, what were sort of the clues, even if you didn't catch it at the time, looking back, the clues that something was coming?
I'm going to tell you right now, brother, nothing. Zero. And that's why this hit me so hard. There was no clues. One of the partner owners of the company that owned the building was one of my first customers. So I had no clue. There was no whispers, no rumors. No one had, no water cooler talk of, hey, the gun guys might be getting, kicked out or something. Nothing. Zero. We were considered, at least I thought, one of the prize tenants. We are a very special business. We share that building with many prominent businesses, including incredibly high-end diamond dealers and jewelers. And when you look at the amount of robberies at high-end jewelry stores in Beverly Hills, to think that we, as the gun shop, could be any kind of a problem when for 2 years, or just shy of 2 years, we've had not one single incident, not one single complaint ever. Zero. In fact, like I just said, I believe that we were, a crown jewel tenant. And, especially because of the press that we get and, the great, the huge client names that we have. Not to say that there's not big names going into the other businesses in the building, too. So I don't think that our clientele base was, impressive for the building owner. But in the end, we did not have your typical gun shopper. I don't want to disparage gun shoppers because it's like those are my people. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure you can understand what I'm saying. Your typical gun guy might have a certain look. He might, he might dress a certain way or, think a certain way. Your stereotypical, tactical, guy versus, a doctor in a, $10,000 suit who's coming in, so the clientele, there was really no worries about any kind of a devaluing of their building, I guess I would say,
I can even sum that up by saying, obviously the McDonald's in Beverly Hills is a much different clientele than the McDonald's someplace else, but these were local people.
We don't even have a McDonald's in Beverly Hills.
Right, but what you're saying is these are local people. These weren't people who were driving from the hills or driving from, outside the area, so that your clientele were consistent with the other businesses and the local businesses
exactly.
In your neighborhood.
You said it much more eloquently than I did, yes. That's what I was trying to say, is that it didn't – we were not a sore thumb, being stuck out because, a certain type of clientele was coming in that would ruin the vibe of the building. It was the complete opposite. So between the fact that we were a legitimate licensed business, I carried a ginormous liability insurance policy, probably more than anybody else in the building. The fact that we had no issues, the fact that the store is quite famous, and I think I've got I've got a right to say that. And if you walk down any street in Beverly Hills, if I wear my company shirts or jackets to any restaurant, any hotel, anywhere in the city, I would get either recognized from my face from being on the news or the logos. Oh my God, there's the gun guy. I'm proud that I feel that I have made the word gun in the city of Beverly Hills a normal retail name. It would be no different than saying I'm going to buy a purse or I'm going to get a drink at Wally's.
Right. And so so when this thing came down, how did – just describe for me, it was a letter, it was an email, and
it was a physical letter.
So go ahead. Tell me what that was like and what went through your mind when you read it and comprehended it.
I was handed a physical letter from the property manager an employee of the property management company. It was devastating, it was an absolute gut punch, it was a donkey kick to the face. And to think that to not only get a letter that says get out, that I'm trying to watch my words, but just to not have the professional courteousness of having the building come to me and say, hey, we're having an issue with you. Or, hey, maybe the business is, now that we're going back to normal times, which I think is comical because crime is like through the roof. But, maybe they wanted to talk about my rent, or maybe they wanted to talk about, moving me to a different floor or something. But instead of just coming to me and saying, hey, maybe there's too much liability in this business for us, or maybe we don't like your clientele, or maybe we don't like the fact that you store, guns and ammo on the fourth floor. Nothing. Like nothing. And also, too, these people understand, these are very wealthy businessmen. These people understand that when I signed my lease, I told them, because how the ATF works is you have to have a signed lease before you can even submit your application. And, of course, California, we have all these other hoops to jump through, like Cal DOJ, and then Los Angeles County's got their hand out, and then the city of Beverly Hills has got their own firearms regulatory permits. So it's a lot of hoops. So I had my lease for probably, I don't have it in front of me, but 4 or 5 months before I could even operate because of all of the licensing that had to go through. They knew that. So to think that they were going to come to me and say, here's a 60-day notice, get out, instead of saying, hey, this is not a good fit for us, but we understand how hard you worked, how much money that you spent, how difficult it was for you to start this business. You got an incredible job building this business and building this brand. We understand it's going to take you several months to, you know, just to get your new licensing. God forbid trying to find a new location because the property has to sign off on your license, you know. So to find another building, if I'm going to duplicate this business model, to try and find another building immediately and have somebody say yes is tough. So I just, so that was the biggest kick for me, was that no word, no warning, no common courteousness to say, hey, we know it's going to take you 4 or 5 months to find somewhere and move and get all your licenses moved over. We want you out, but we'll give you enough time to survive. Nothing. So to say that they don't give a shit, I think, is a very accurate statement.
Yeah. And so the last thing, Russ, and I understand you're going to be talking to John Hines Tuesday, and I think, did Stephanie Hamill's producer call you from One American News?
No, not yet.
Okay, so Justine, who's Stephanie Hamill's booker producer in Washington, I talked to her and I gave her your number. So,
okay,
so that's in the offing. It was a tough show on Friday because everything is, they shoot at 1 o'clock. It's a live to tape.
Yeah, of course.
So, yeah, but anyway, the last question is, you know, you don't have to use any names, but if you could just sort of tell me, what has been the reaction from your clientele and other supporters of your store since they heard the news?
It's been overwhelmingly positive. I mean, obviously they're sad, but the amount of support, people have reached out to me on social media. I've had major celebrities call me and say, Russ, I just heard, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Who could I call? Can I donate some money to your like moving fund? Are you suing the people? I mean, I've had so much incredible support. You know, I'm very fortunate that I've got clients who are in the real estate business. So they've all been calling. I'm racking my brain. I'm calling all my friends who's got a building. So to think that the word had gotten out within 2 hours of me having that letter and me, you know, just kind of mentioning it to two of my client friends, probably over 150 people called me. And is, you know, and now, of course, the Breitbart article and, in fact, a client of mine just sent me a TikTok video. I'm not on TikTok, or I mean, I've got an account, but I don't use it. But he just sent me a TikTok video of some guy that's doing a whole kind of like a speech about the Breitbart article, saying, you know, of course, it's California who, during the height of the crime wave, shuts down the gun shop. So the amount of kind of news that this is getting, and the amount of support from my clients and just the general public now has been, you know, incredible.
Oh, that's great. Russ, I just really feel for you, man. And I get what is happening to you. And I'm trying to explain to my kids, you know, I'm 56 years old. My kids are in their 20s and 30s. But I'm trying to explain to them that life was not like this. Like, you know, I grew up as a very active, you know, college Republican, like right wing. I called myself Reagan Youth. And I understood that people disagreed with me, but nobody was trying to put me in jail. No one was trying to, like, get me fired. You know, it was just a different time. And now it's like, now there's like it's like people are playing for blood now. And it's you know, it's taking me a while to get used to it, and I'm very sorry about what you're going through.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm 45. Yeah, you know, I turned 46 in a couple months, and I just came from a hard working family. You know, I came from Canada, made it to Beverly Hills. You know, it's like, you know, I tried to, you know, like, do the American dream. And I felt like I had it. Sure, I was in a controversial business in this state, especially in this city. But like I said, you know, I felt like I was, you know, I didn't have a storefront. I wasn't, you know, marketing guns on the street. I mean, I don't do any advertising. I barely have a website. You know, I'm not active on social media for the gun shop. it tried to be as discreet as possible, which was the total opposite of, you know, most companies' business models. And then also, too, I tried to bring a more of a safety awareness to the gun consumer. I tried to, especially during the pandemic and now during this crime wave, where I have so many first-time gun buyers. I'd say more than half my clients right now are women who are terrified, who don't know, you know, they go up to a shop up in the valley and they're kind of treated like crap just because the fact that the you know, traditional gun store is really not for the first-time buyer. You know, those people don't take the time to, you know, to give you that special attention. My appointments are all one-on-one. So there's no, you know, threat of salesmanship, and there's no, you know, pushing some sale down your throat. I work with the client to sometimes even say, ma'am, this gun's not even for you. You know, maybe we're going to get you a taser or get you some pepper spray, you know. So I just tried to bring people's Second Amendment rights to a place where that is a dirty, you know, that's a dirty two words. You know, and yeah. I tried to do it, in a classy way that was not intimidating. And what I mean by that is even to the city. I didn't want the city of Beverly Hills to think that I was pushing this gun narrative and making sure that if you say Beverly Hills, then you have to say guns. It was the total opposite. I tried to make it as discreet as humanly possible because I did not want it to be about guns. I wanted it to be about public safety.
Right. You believed, you took them at their word that they cared about safety and they cared about all these things, and they just wanted you, that they were just, you know, their point that they're just trying to be responsible when actually they just want to get rid of you.
Exactly. You couldn't have said it better.
All right, man. And what was the name of your town in Vancouver?
Sorry?
Your town in Vancouver, what was it? You grew up in Vancouver, Vancouver.
Yeah, I grew up in Vancouver, BC, yeah.
What, the actual city, though, did you, or was it like a city like 10 miles?
No, the city of Vancouver, yeah.
All right, fantastic. Hey, Russ, I really appreciate it. Thanks, man.
Of course, brother.
Take care.